it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Hi, everyone. I am Natalie, and I'm an organizer. I'm a Central American organizer. I currently organize with the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. I was born into the struggle as a family who was very militant during our own civil war, and my family was displaced all over the world. And this is how we ended up in Los Angeles, and that really informs the work that I do as somebody who has survived the consequences of war and family displacement and family separation. And we still continue to see that with our Central American community and other migrants in transit.
Hi, everyone. My pseudonym is Cielito Lindo. I am a Jewish mestiza who identifies as having ancestors from the Iberian Peninsula, Guatemala, and Germany. Jewish ancestor, and I co-founded an organization that works at the intersection of migrant justice, indigenous rights, environmental justice, and drug policy.
So just to kind of start us off, I mean, we're going to be covering a lot of ground, everything from policies to far-ranging things, but I just want to kind of pick your brain to start off. You know, when you all either watch the news or hear it on the radio, when you see, you know, everything that's happening along the border and with the caravan, I mean, not just the stupid things that Trump says and just the, you know, the racist bile that comes out of his mouth, but in terms of, you know, so-called like center or even liberal reporting from stuff like CNN, what do you think that, you know, on average, most Americans just are not getting in terms of the broader context and just, you know, stuff that is not even being discussed?
I think it goes back to, it's kind of complicated, right? It's like we're talking about the caravans. There's so many different angles that you can talk about in migration, right? But I think the most important thing before we can even understand what's happening in current day, we need to understand that U.S. intervention, U.S. imperialism is everywhere, right? Specifically in Central America. And this goes back to the Monroe Doctrine, right? The Monroe Doctrine saying that Latin America was very close to the United States, and it was a region of interest. And this is a region where the United States is going to continue keeping an eye on. So we're going back to the early 1800s. And throughout history, we're seeing slowly how, you know, specifically Central America, because it's super close to us, right? We're seeing the United States coming in with transnational companies, with banana companies, with different exploiting people, right? And so just understanding that this has been happening for nearly 100 years. Just to focus and clarify things a little more better, I think we should focus on the last 40 years of U.S. intervention in the region. Central America, unfortunately, has been known to have some of the bloodiest, you know, heartbreaking civil wars and conflicts. And a lot of those conflicts were directly because of U.S. interventions. I can speak with the simple fact that El Salvador had a 12-year-old civil war, a 80-year-old conflict, and specifically around most of the population really fighting the oligarchies, these 12 families that own everything, right? And the 12 families have had long relationships with U.S. companies and U.S. presidents. And, you know, when people started slowly revolting and fighting, the United States felt that, you know, they labeled them as terrorists, like communists, Marxists, these awful people, when in reality, they were just people uprising. And, you know, there were farm workers, there were students, and there were union organizers, and, you know, the United States funded the Salvadorian Civil War. We're talking about $1 million a day that was sent to El Salvador with military aid. And not only that, we're talking about the fact that the United States funded and trained our soldiers with the School of the Americas. We're talking about Guatemala. It was a 40-year-old conflict. It was the genocide of indigenous people, killing over 200,000 people. We're talking about Nicaragua, right? So it's the first interventions we're seeing in the region. And then now we're seeing the consequences of the 2009 coup that the United States supported with the order of Hillary Clinton and Obama to come and oust democratically elected President Mel Zelaya, because he was going to change the constitution to help the Hungarian people. And we did not like that. And we funded a military coup, and we took him out of power, and we put Juan Orlando. And since then, we're still seeing the consequences of that. And this is why 80% of the caravans from the last 2 years are from people from Honduras, because they're fleeing. And understanding that we are a direct result of that. And since the outing of Juan Orlando, of Mel Zelaya, and putting Juan Orlando in power, we've seen over 300 activists being killed in Honduras.
So on my end, something that I think that mainstream media doesn't report is a critical analysis gang activity or the origin of gang. And so to continue on activism, Natalie, I think it's important that we recognize that gangs originated in Los Angeles, and gangs formed as a result of the exodus of Central American refugees during the 80s due to the civil wars caused by U.S. military intervention. And so, first of all, there were gangs that had formed in Los Angeles in response to white nationalist violence, KKK groups that were persecuting people of color here in Los Angeles. So there was gangs of African folks. There was gangs of Mexican folks. I think they were the alternatives to clubs. Natalie, if you have anything to add for it, ever finish my thoughts.
Essentially, going back to the issue of gangs, I think let's look at the name, right? And I think it will really talk to you about the necessity, right? So La Mara Sabratucha, La Mara, the word Mara means posse. And it was a very common word, my Mara, you're my crew, you're my posse, you're my buddy, right? And it was something that was used in Salvadoran slang all the time. And it was never something negative. And we see that, you know, during the 80s, some of the most horrible times for Central America where millions of people are being displaced. And, you know, we're talking about youth who had to flee and trauma, folks who experience all their village being killed, folks who experience, you know, their loved ones, their schoolmates being killed, coming to a country that does not want us here, coming to a city as Los Angeles that has had its fair share of urban issues historically with, you know, black gangs and other Mexican gangs. And the same reason why gangs are formed, not trying to criminalize or humanize that experience, but it's the lack of resources. It's the harassment. It's the alienation, right? So these groups of youth came from Central America, countries that have experienced horrible civil wars with little resources, with trauma, come to a city as big as Los Angeles and communities where people are fighting for resources. They didn't see any other way but creating groups, you know, posses, mi mara, you're my posse, as a way of survival. And then, you know, through things that happen because of urbanization or because of different things, you know, we see the phenomenon of gangs being completely exaggerated and becoming everywhere. And that's something that I talk when I talk about Central America. Yes, Central America has had its fair share of violence and wars, right? And resistance, but also to understand that gangs are not something of Central America. That is something that we got in the United States that was created in our own backyards. It is the consequences of us intervening in countries and people displacing with lack of resources and criminalization and gang injunctions and then ultimately immigration policies. These people, they were not granted asylum. Many of these people were incarcerated for drug substance abuse, you know, during the 80s where the crack epidemic was very, you know, affecting the streets of LA. And it has to do with Central America because, as we know, the U.S. funded the Contras of Nicaragua with the money that they were selling drugs in South Central and with the Iran, you know, arms deal. So it's all very, in my opinion, purposely done to keep people down and create this illusion of the, of a very exaggerated drug war to create more militarization and repression of many people across the borders, just not in our homelands, but also in Latin America.
For me, it's important for mainstream media to recognize why gangs exist. And I think it's, there needs to be reparations rather than mass deporting gangs or, you know, accusing them of bringing violence into the U.S. or importing violence. We need to think about how the U.S. exported violence to Central America during the 20th century. And then how that produced collective trauma in our homeland and how that collective trauma was transmitted intergenerationally from the people who survived those massacres to the people who also had to turn against their people and transgress, like, against their own people and commit atrocities, who also migrated to the U.S. because they were also fleeing that violence and that trauma that they were forced to dehumanize their own people by the training of the U.S. through the School of the Americas, and how that got transmitted to the young, to the younger generations, and how that violence from colonialism, from U.S. imperialism and U.S. militarism, how that gets transmitted from one generation to another, and how that shows up in gang culture. What is gang culture but the continuation of colonialism and U.S. imperialism in youth? And it's devastating, really. Something I want to see more analysis around is how, I mean, and we can get into this further, but, you know, when Trump first started his campaign, his rhetoric mirrored a lot of the rhetoric that was used to expand the border in the earlier 20th century. And that was when, there was, Harry Anslinger, who was the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, was, you know, creating rhetoric to legitimize the prohibition of marijuana. And he was saying, and he was speaking against basically the threat of communism and labor and anarchist organizing along the border, because there was a lot of marijuana vendors who were crossing the border and bringing in marijuana to the United States and selling it. And so Harry Anslinger, a bunch of people in Hollywood and other folks, you know, they didn't want Mexican folks to succeed in the and have a successful trade around marijuana. So they start to cast Mexicans who are smuggling marijuana along the border as rapists, as murderers, and how we need to protect ourselves from them. And so it becomes a legitimization for the expansion of the border and a border ideology. And sure enough, like within a few years, marijuana is prohibited on the federal level. And so something I noticed was that there was a lot of deja vu around the rhetoric when he first launched his campaign, that Mexicans and Central Americans, you know, were bringing in violence and drugs and trafficking and the gangs. And that's just a continuation of fracturing Ayala, Turtle Island, fragmenting the land, and legitimizing open-air prisons and continuing to export violence to the region to legitimize having control, geopolitical control over the region, and proliferating arms in the region to continue destabilizing the region so that the U.S. and other multinational corporations can continue to take over and colonize all of Mesoamerica.
Awesome. Well, thank you for all those thoughts as we begin. As another far-reaching question, what is causing people broadly to join these caravans and take such a long and sometimes very dangerous journey?
Something that I wanted to just bring conversation in, something I want to talk in the conversation was a little bit of like current U.S. Push foreign policies that are affecting migration, one of them being Mexico's southern border strategy, Plan Frontera Sur, which is intended to hold back, you know, drugs coming to the United States. It's another strategy that was implemented by Congress to ensure that, you know, the war on drugs is, which we know is really a war on, you know, activists and poor people, really has this grip. So that's the first time that we started seeing the militarization of the southern border and also the southern parts of Mexico, right? We know that it is international human rights law to allow the free passage of anyone, right? And if you are from Central America, because it is technically considered an unofficial union, you freely should be allowed to cross within borders, right? But then after Plan Frontera Sur, we saw Alliance for the Prosperity, Alianza la Prosperidad, which was kind of, you know, it was the United States claimed that it was like, you know, written by the three Northern Triangle countries, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. But in reality, it was written by the watchful eye of the United States. So it started with this idea of Plan Frontera, Plan Colombia, which was this U.S. foreign policy that was supposed to stop the flow of drugs in Colombia. But in reality, what it did is it displaced internally displaced many Colombians, right? And, you know, there was this famous article that you can check in the New York Times that Joe Biden wrote saying, Plan Colombia was magnificent. It was such success. We should do something very similar to in Central America. And this is where the idea came to create Alliance for the Prosperity, because it was supposed to provide, you know, humanitarian aid, the stop of migration. It was supposed to create all these resources for these three countries specifically to address the violence of the gangs. But what it has done, this $750 million that is coming from our, yesterday was tax day, it's coming from our taxes. What it has done, it has completely militarized all the Central American borders. Has displaced indigenous people and has displaced farmers who do not have the capacity to continue doing the work they're doing because of the militarization of their borders. It's stopping the flow of miners and it's doing so much. At this point, it has been implemented. So that's the first time that we started seeing like a second insurgent of the United States focusing on refocusing in Central America, because in the 80s, it was very focused, right? And we saw that with the crisis of the unaccompanied minors. And I forget if it's 2010, 2012, when we saw 5,000, 10,000 unaccompanied minors coming for seeking asylum from the gangs. And that is when the United States, created all these programs. So, because in their head, we cannot have these minors coming to our homelands. And another policy that was implemented was that they wanted to stop the migration of youth. So they militarized the southern states of Mexico. And they're saying the statistics show that unaccompanied minors stopped coming to the U.S. But the reality is that Mexico has been deporting about 20,000 unaccompanied minors since 2012. And they get paid for every minor they deport back to Central America. So I think it's important for us to understand these policies that are making it hard. To answer your direct question, I think why we're seeing these huge caravans, because people know that going through Mexico is very dangerous, right? We hear from our parents, we hear from our neighbors who did it in the 80s and the 90s. So caravans, small amount of caravans have always happened, right? It's a way of safety. It's a way of coming together. It's a way of making sure that, you know, you're safe through this very dangerous passage. But we saw the huge caravan happen because of specifically what happened in Honduras, right? In 2010, that's when we see Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. This is why folks were referring to her as Killary, because she came and she supported and she outed Mel Zelaya, causing huge uprisings in Honduras, right? It's specifically because Honduras is a country where it's been very strategized to create U.S. military bases, right? It is very close to El Salvador. It's very close to Nicaragua. And those are the two countries that currently still have leftist presidents, right? Los Sandinistas and the FMLN, right? So that does not benefit the United States at all. So what we saw is the first uprising of Honduras, right? And that's where we see the death of Berta Cáceres, the indigenous Lenca leader who was fighting to, you know, support they were going to build this big dam in Lenca territory, right? So that's the first phase. And that's when you started seeing more people being displaced from Honduras. But last year, a little bit between, I can't remember the dates, March, there was the elections in Honduras where it was the current dictator, as people are calling him, Juan Orlando, and this other, moderate leftist, president candidate were running, and people who were there, you know, they said the lights were going off, the military was repressing the voting, and essentially it was a fraudulent election, and he lost it, but he claimed that he won it. And he immediately, Trump completely dignified him as president. We were happy. We were like, he's a great president. We gave him the right to be president. And in reality, it was a fraudulent election. And since that, in March of last year, that's when we're seeing a huge 5,000, 2,000, 3,000 caravans because of the repression of the fraudulent election. It's not living circumstances. In many ways, it's a war in Honduras. And that is the first time that we saw the huge caravans coming to the United States, right? When, and usually they always go unseen because 100, 200, 300 people, not 1,000 plus people at once.
So something I'd like to add is the role that climate change is playing in forcing people to migrate from the Northern Triangle. So due to scarce rainfall, the crops that folks grow in Central America, such as coffee, they're just not yielding as much as they used to. And a lot of people are unable to find work, are unable to continue growing. And some of them will move into the larger cities, for example, in Honduras or Guatemala. And so before they migrate out of the Northern Triangle due to violence in the cities, it's also because they've migrated from rural areas, rural regions where they used to grow to the cities. And so there's just people who don't have the same access to work, and there's just food scarcity due to climate change and less rainfall. So that's another reason why people are leaving in the caravans and the larger exodus in general.
And that climate change can definitely be attributed to the transnational companies like Coca-Cola, Chiquita Banana, all these transnational companies that are stealing the limited resources. Because I can give you an example. El Salvador is one of the country, because after the peace accords in 92 is when CAFTA was created, and CAFTA completely came to El Salvador. And, you know, this country that was recovering from war, we started seeing them building like huge malls and all these different things that are not necessarily for the growth of El Salvador. And one of the things that they started doing was really like devastating our limited resources. And at this point, we're very limited in water. And one of some of those consequences is that the general population does not have access to water. You get water access maybe 3 hours a day if you're lucky. But companies like Coca-Cola, which they need a lot of water to create, you know, their products, or El Salvador is a country where 80% of its sugarcane production is coming to the United States, and sugarcane needs a lot of water to cultivate. And that's really taking the resources. And we're seeing that these companies are really causing a lot of environmental havoc. And this is why people are fleeing. And even as my partner can tell you, when we talk to people, a lot of people would tell you that they just had no choice because they couldn't grow any food and there was no water. And the craziest stories of these climate refugees in many ways.
I'm just curious now if we could turn towards Mexico's role in all this. How have they responded to the caravans, and also how have they responded due to Trump's threats, either to like impose tariffs or to shut down the border? You know, how do those things interact with each other?
To be really honest, Mexico and Central American relations have been very, you know, tense for many, many years. You know, the passage of Central Americans to Mexico has been something that has been challenging for the first exodus. I like to refer as the first exodus of Central Americans as the ones that fled to war in the '80s. And this is the, like, the second exodus, huge, massive exodus we're seeing from the region. The United States, has always, you know, paid for more militarization and surveillance of those regions and provide them with the tools they need and military, supplies. Also understanding that, you know, there's a lot of corruption because of the drugs and war, and a lot of migrants fear for their life and are being disappeared. A lot of women are being, unfortunately, trafficked, and children. I do know that in the role of the unaccompanied minors, Mexico gets money for every child they deport back to Central America. I've seen it happen. I've been in El Salvador where people have been returned, and I've talked to their experience and how they're treated. They also profile people. They profile, if you look Central American, we'll stop you. You know, and of course, Central America is such a diverse region. We look very different, all of us, right? But they will, like, criminalize you and profile you. Currently, right now, I think one of the toughest things in Tijuana is that people are scared. Migrants hide. Migrants hide because the police recognizes if you're part of the caravan. And also another thing that we've been told is that whenever we've taken migrants to get any medical support, they've been discriminated. They've been, you know, they haven't been supported with all the medical help they needed. But I think the most important is the fact that they have been colluding with the United States and kind of stopping the flow of unaccompanied minors. We know that in Tijuana, the Mexican police had authority to arrest any migrant child that looks like they're part of the caravan, right? So any child that's walking in the street, they were already profiling youth, and they were profiling them, they were stopping them, they were arresting them. And it was up to their discretion if they wanted to give them up to the Mexican Child Services or if they wanted to deport them and not allow them to even seek asylum. And that's been a challenge that we've seen. This is why we have, I don't know, we at one given point, we've had 30, 40 unaccompanied youth who are not even being allowed to get close to the port of entry. And the Mexican police has been helping them and making sure that that happens.
And to add on to that, it's against federal Mexican law for someone to house or transport unaccompanied migrant youth. So one can be charged with smuggling or trafficking if you help an unaccompanied migrant youth. And that's just another way that the Mexican government obstructs services from being provided to arguably one of the most vulnerable populations of refugees seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border. And so when Trump is talking about human trafficking in his speeches and, you know, adopting policies that tackle human trafficking, he's really not, I mean, it's all a performance, because the policies that he's actually putting into place, such as the Remain in Mexico policy, exacerbates human trafficking, especially when help to asylum seekers is criminalized in Mexico.
Well, I want to turn now to your thoughts on the buildup of troops and military infrastructure along the border. You know, most people remember a lot around the holiday time, you know, Trump was saying, I'm sending the troops to the border. And a lot of those troops have gone home. But I think unbeknownst to a lot of people, the Pentagon has actually beefed up and sent a lot of troops or National Guard there. They've been working on various infrastructure projects, putting up things like barbed wire. And also famously, as we reported on, it's going down. I mean, when people at times have tried to cross and seek asylum, there have been, you know, military agents there along the border, along with Border Patrol, shooting tear gas and making sure people aren't able to cross. I'm just curious your thoughts on either the role of military or, you know, what does this signify that there is this buildup right now?
I mean, the role of military surveillance and presence is not new to the border, right? And we're talking about the southern border, and we're also talking about the other invisible border, which is in the southern parts of Mexico and Central America, right? In the last 5 years, we have seen more U.S. involvement in sense of creating more Navy forces, more, you know, Army stations in Centroamérica, specifically Honduras, and expanding the ones that are created already in El Salvador and other places. So it's not new, right? I just think that now, because it's the media that's really addressing the issue, we're seeing images. Yes, I've never seen National Guard members in the border. That's very new. I can give you an example of how devastating that is, because every year for the past couple of years, there's been a border convergence called the SOA. The SOA Watch has been calling people to come to the Nogales, Arizona border. And that border is very different than Tijuana, because, you know, Tijuana is one of the busiest borders in the world. Huge border, right? Very different to the small border of Nogales, Mexico. And, you know, there's a lot of deported veterans. There's a lot of deported people that live in Nogales. And essentially, the border wall was not very, it was just a regular wall. It didn't have the extra security precautions, right? So during Sunday, you see people going, talking to the loved ones on the other side, right? I happened to be in Arizona the weekend that the National Guard came in and added the extra layer of security in the border. And like, you see the devastation of people not being able to touch their loved ones on the other side of the border. And I think that's a consequence that we're seeing now, because that border was never that militarized until the last year.
So on my end, something I've been reflecting on is how Trump has been speaking nonsense in the past week about potentially having the military administer interim tent cities along the border to support with the processing of asylum seekers. And that to me just shows a total collapse of the U.S. government. If people who have been trained to kill are the ones who are receiving people fleeing economic and material violence in the Northern Triangle. To me, it sounds like more open air prisons. It sounds like internment camps. And when, let's be honest, when, what follows the internment camps is often deportation back to conflict zones. Let's call it what it is. It's actually not an internment camp. It's a concentration camp, because the U.S. government is consciously deporting people back to places where they are fleeing violence that are likely to cause premature death. So let's call it what it is. These are concentration camps. And if they're going to be run by the military, the Defense Department, it's ethnic cleansing at its finest, because most of asylum seekers are indigenous, are mestizo. So this is part of a larger trend of ethnic cleansing here in Central America and other parts of the world. So I think it's really disturbing what's happening, to have people who are not culturally competent or providing trauma-informed care to asylum seekers fleeing conditions of extermination, and for the U.S. to be returning people to conditions of extermination is participation and complicity in the system of extermination. So I'm disturbed, to say the least.
You know, just to go back to one of the things you were talking about, was just the amount of people that cross the border every day. It's just funny when people, especially on the right, you know, pundits, people like Tucker Carlson or whoever, you know, bring up this kind of trope of like open borders. But in reality, I mean, you know, these borders are open. I mean, like literally, like, you know, what is it, like over $1 billion in trade is made each day between Mexico and the U.S. I mean, there's people going back and forth. There's people that have jobs. There's people that have families. So, I mean, it's not so much that, you know, the borders are open. It's just the level of policing and the level of, you know, state control over that area. Because, I mean, there's people going back and forth all the time, no matter what.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's people, I mean, Americans cross into Tijuana. I forgot the statistic. I think more than 5,000 Americans cross into Tijuana in a daily basis. Right. That's a lot of flow of people.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, just continuing on. So let's now talk about you know, something different. You know, what is the connection between everything that we've talked about so far, what's happening along the border, and also the war on drugs and the war on terror? How do these things intersect and, you know, support each other?
So one thing that I've been really trying to reflect on and kind of understand is the how there is a border crisis, right? It might not be Trump's border crisis, but there is a border crisis. Tijuana is this perfect example of all these failed U.S. interventions and drug policies, right? We're not only seeing this region of Tijuana where the Central American caravan is, we're also seeing deported veterans and we're seeing deported people from the United States, right? We're seeing the Black migrants coming from all over the world, from Africa, from the Caribbean. And we're still seeing the Haitian families that have been there for 2 years. And then we're seeing a new wave of Haitian families that are coming in from Venezuela and are coming in from Brazil, right? Very like Brazil leaning to the right now and the destabilization of Venezuela. So these families who were displaced in Haiti, who were living in South America are made their way to Tijuana. And then, additionally, what we're seeing is also internally displaced people from Mexico, from Oaxaca, from Acapulco, from Guerrero, these places where the cartel wars and, you know, they're cartel states and the war on drugs is really affecting them. And they're also displaced. So we're seeing this group of very different, you know, circumstances in many ways, but at the same time, displacement of all these groups that no one is talking about. No one is talking about. I've also come across asylum seekers from the Middle East and Tijuana, you know, a lot of women from Nigeria, Sudan, and those are also places where the U.S. is heavily involved. So it's really a global issue. It's a global crisis that we're not talking about. So understanding that the war on terror and 9/11 completely changed the border politics and border policies, right? That is when we saw the creation of ICE. Because of 9/11 with this excuse of fighting terror, right? Regardless if it comes from whatever region we're looking into with this excuse, right? Of surveilling more people, militarizing more people. And that has to do with direct result of 9/11. Before that, there was no ICE customs. There was none of that. The border looked very different. You know, they didn't ask for these extra precautions when crossing. So we've seen the consequences of 9/11 really forever changing the way we interact with our borders. But we also know that, you know, that same militarization of the southern border is not the same militarization we see in the Canadian border. So that also tells you, like, who are you really trying to, like, lie to about this war on terror and the flow of criminals, when in reality it's like, you know, I think there's more, it's a very white supremacist perspective of working with these border policies.
So after 9/11, the war on drugs was declared in 2006. Much mm-hmm. like the war on terror, the war on drugs was designed to reproduce the conditions that legitimize its expansion of globalized militarization under the myth of national security. Under the rhetoric of national security, mm-hmm. people who trade drugs for money or who use drugs are casted as threats to public safety and are punished for self-medicating and surviving economic injustice by being incarcerated and deported. If we look past the surface of insightful rhetoric that conflates Central American exoduses with criminality associated with human trafficking, drugs, rape, and murder, it becomes undeniable that demand for psychoactives is a universal marker of human nature. There's a huge demand for cocaine and opiates, among other drugs scheduled under Schedule 1, which means that they are like the most prohibited, which means that the punishment is the highest for those drugs. And as there has been for marijuana. And so with cocaine, heroin, and marijuana, those are all psychoactive substances that are associated with racialized people. So those are racialized substances. And therefore, you know, the populations associated with those substances are disproportionately policed and criminalized for their use and for participating in trading them. So, for example, the U.S. and neoliberal and its neoliberal partners in Latin America, they don't want indigenous or campesino populations to have control, autonomy, or self-determination over the means of production of psychoactive medicinal plant
plants. So over the course of history, the U.S. has prohibited production and sale in order to create an entire economic boom around suppressing autonomy around the growth and sale of medicinal plants.
Oh, you know, something that I failed to mention, also understanding when it comes to the drug war, is that Centroamérica is the middle passage, right? It's the middle passage to the north. It's the middle passage of whatever drug is coming from South America, goes through Centroamérica, gonna go to the north, which is Mexico, ultimately making its way to the U.S., right? So this is another way that all these policies have been justified, and all these militarization of people of regions in Central America, right? Because they want to stop the flow of violence, they want to stop the flow of drugs coming to the north. And currently there's specifically in Central America, we're seeing more of like the ambassadors being foremost. Yeah, like for example, the person who just got appointed by Trump, it's a former CIA head who is going to be the ambassador of El Salvador, right? And that's very scary, right? We're not talking about that, right? Or we're not talking about Abrams, right? The person who has been appointed by Trump to do this Venezuela strategy, when in reality, this person was pardoned by Bush, right? This person who essentially covered all the genocide of Guatemala and covered one of the most heinous massacres in Latin America, which is the massacre of El Mozote. In December 4th, 1981, there was a village of approximately 900 people, which, you know, many of them had affiliation to the left. And, you know, these military soldiers came in and killed everyone. There was not any survivors in the town. And Abrams was one of the person who helped cover that. And he was found responsible for that. But now he is the person creating a strategy in Venezuela. So that's ultimately just going to displace more people. We're seeing people from Venezuela and Tijuana coming our way.
Ryan, we've touched on this a little bit, but now I wanted to turn towards the devastating impact of U.S. intervention and imperialism within Central American countries.
You know, there was a moment in time in the last couple of years that, you know, we felt that Central America was really relieving itself from the hold of the United States, right? Specifically with the winning of these leftist governments, right? And Nicaragua being one of them, although Nicaragua was also having active conflict, right? And El Salvador, you know, the formal rebels becoming a political leftist party and winning both seats of the last two elections in El Salvador. And, you know, and then in the case of Mel Zelaya, he was the first president in Honduras, which really was calling out the U.S. and not allowing them to continue doing stuff in Central America, right? So what a lot of people are talking about, we're so used to seeing talking about military coups, but we're not talking about slow coups, right? Slow coups are not necessarily military. They are destabilization of the left. We're seeing a lot of lies being told about leftist representation in Central America. We're seeing a lot of lies, the right-wing media, and that's something that it's another way that the U.S. is continuing controlling all the media and everything that's coming out of Centroamérica. I have spoken to people in Honduras who have no idea all these negative things that are happening in the U.S. in terms of the caravan. And they're like, we don't hear that nobody wants us in the U.S. We don't know that the U.S. is incarcerating our families and separating our families, because that's not what the media is telling them in Honduras. Right? It's very controlled. They're trying to privatize the water in El Salvador, and that's just going to ultimately displace more people. You know, the social movements are really asking for us to really hold our country accountable and stop the flow of more money. I know that recently Trump made an announcement that he was going to stop, humanitarian aid, which is USAID aid. But in reality, that does not mean he's stopping military expending in Centroamérica. They're just stopping the little bit of aid that actually helps social programs, but they're not stopping the aid to stop training their officers, right? We know that the Honduran, Guatemalan, and Salvadoran police officers or police academies are being trained by New York PD, also as well as the Israeli forces in Israel.
We're now going to turn towards the situation within detention facilities, both, you know, in Tijuana, but also along, you know, the border in the United States. You know, in your opinion and what you've seen, I mean, what are the conditions like? I mean, obviously Americans see a lot of stuff on TV, you know, just, you know, pretty horrific images, children being separated from the parents. But I mean, what's the reality of what people are facing inside these facilities?
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? Because I think detention facilities have always been horrible, right? The last couple of years, we're seeing a lot of violations. So I'll give you an example. On Friday, I was in a youth conference for recently arrived Central American and Mexican youth. And the director of the program asked the youth that, unfortunately, the first introduction to the United States was incarceration. And he asked, how many of you all have been incarcerated when you came to the United States? And there's approximately 400 kids that came to the conference. I want to say about half of them raised their hand. And they're like, me, right? So currently I'm working with unaccompanied minors, and they have told me about the awful food conditions, about the way they, all the racial comments they hear, about the way that they're not like allowed to take showers, and the way they're like really messed with it with psychologically, and the way they're not allowed to like check in with their loved ones. We know that currently there is a hunger strike in Adelanto, which is another private detention center where it's not the first hunger strike, right? So the first hunger strike that was really big was last year, and it was the first caravan members that wanted to really bring socialization of what was happening in Adelanto, and they went on a hunger strike, and it was 10 of them, and they were beat up by the guards. They were like, cold water was thrown at them. They were force fed, and it's actually they're currently part of a lawsuit towards Adelanto. You know, so a lot of them will tell you they physically hurt us. They physically threw things at us. They beat us up. One of the asylum seekers almost had his chest cavity broken. These are conversations that we're not talking. There's a lot of women that are having miscarries because they're not being properly supported. There's a lot of sexual abuse. So something about family separation is that there was this historical settlement called the Flores settlement that happened in 2012, I believe. And it was essentially because of a 16-year-old girl that came from El Salvador who was fleeing violence. They arrested her. They put her in detention. And when they arrested her, they had her in like handcuffs for hours. And this became this like international, like, you know, scandal, like the United States is treating minors awful. And this is where the settlement came, that they have to have certain guidelines for these youth to be in detention. One of them being that a youth can, under the age of 18, cannot be in detention more than 20 days. Right. And this is where we're seeing the family separations and kids still being in detention past 20 days. And it's a violation of that settlement.
Yeah. Let's talk directly about, child separation. I mean, I think most people, if they just kind of watch the news and that's kind of just how they follow along, I mean, people have heard about child separations, but I feel that there's a there's an idea that it's over now. Like, they stopped allowing them to do that. What's the reality, actually?
Absolutely not. I know of two brothers. They're Mexican asylum seekers, and for Mexican community, their asylum process is even harder. And they have been in detention for 4 months, and they have been separated from each other. And their parents are, you know, as many people talking about family separations, right? There's always different units of families that flee. You know, just like my dad came first, and then my mother came, and then my sisters came. So a lot of these kids want to live with their parents who are in the United States, and they're still in detention. It's been 3 months. And I just heard that they might be released next week. Some of the kids that I've spoken with, I believe one of the youth who just turned 18, he was in detention for 8 months. 8 months, and sexually incarcerated.
So what happens to these kids? I mean, they get separated from their parents, and then, I mean, if they get what happens? And it just seems like so archaic, just that these massive bureaucracies don't have the ability just to, like, find their parents.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's happening is that they're making it, immigration is making it very difficult to release a child. So, for example, there's many kids that they have family in the U.S. They don't necessarily know them because they live in another country. So there's not, like, any proof that they're related. So, like, they're asking for, like, oh, yeah, that's your aunt. Oh, that's your dad. Great. We have to see a picture with you with them to be able to release you. And we know that many of these people, because of these invisible, ridiculous borders that are very real to people, right? They haven't been with their father since they were two, since they were three. So there's no pictures to prove that. So that's another barrier that's happening. I do know that currently there's 20 families on the other side, about 20 families that sued the United States because they were deported and their children were left in the United States. Yeah, and they're essentially seeking that process in Tijuana, in Mexicali. Yeah.
And then for kids that are just stuck in the system, I mean, do they just stay there indefinitely? I mean,
no. So this is a couple things can happen. If you are a child that does not have any proof of family, you will be essentially a ward of the state, and you will be you will go to a group home.
Something like the, like the Catholic Charities in Chicago are running. I think Hopeland.
Yes.
Right. Actually, those were recently shut down.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, they're also like benefiting from these children, right? Just like the foster care system getting all this money, and these youth are not getting the resources they need. There's also a lot of youth that who do not have sponsors, who do not have family in the United States, and that their process gets really tricky. If they don't get lucky enough to be released to a group home like that, you know, there's a group home in LA that has currently 12 housing 12 minors, you're essentially just lost in the system.
To add on to that, if some youth don't have access to getting into a group home, they'll get transferred to ICE custody upon turning 18. So on their 18th birthday, they're put in shackles. They're shackled in front of their friends on their 18th birthday, and they're transferred to ICE custody. And that is how their transition into, you know, what is constructed as adulthood is like within the migrant crimmigration system. And then they're transferred to an ICE facility.
Yeah. And at that point, there's little that can be done. You skip the window of seeking asylum for an unaccompanied minor because there is laws that protect youth migrants if they're able to file on time. I do know of a certain person who was 17 when he seeked asylum. He aged out and he was sent to Adelanto, and he was there for almost a year and a half.
Do you want to comment on just the situation in Tijuana? People that are waiting to get in. I know we've talked about this before on this program, but anything else you want to add? I mean, again, just another, I mean, it just seems so silly in so many ways. I mean, people are just, you know, just a slow pace of people getting numbers and then not knowing when they're going to be called. And I think to most people, it just doesn't even make any sense.
I mean, it's ridiculous, right? Because I know one of the excuses that Border Patrol has gave us, and I haven't done accompaniment. I know Celito has, to folks. She's accompanying folks to the border. So they don't have the capacity to process everyone. But I mean, I've seen them come to warehouse and take hundreds of people at once. So I think that's just a bullshit lie.
So let's see. I find Tijuana to be an extension of an open air prison. So folks who are trapped in Tijuana earlier in the year, so in fall, they were all crammed into a really small two different sports arenas, and both of those were placed in really dangerous neighborhoods where there's arms trade happening, illicit economies around drugs and human trafficking. So really just a place that would exacerbate their vulnerability. And for a while, like, it just wasn't, even when it was state run, it did not guarantee safety. People went missing. Then when it started raining, I know that a lot of men took advantage of people's circumstances and, solicited young migrants or just desperate migrants and offered to provide them with housing if they traded sex. And that's not consensual trading of sex. That's, preying and exploiting people's desperation. So it's not dignified, sex, an exchange of dignified sex trade. So something that we've also seen is that there are people that are introducing meth to asylum seekers. And what that does is, there's just so much to unpack, right? Something that I personally witnessed is the infiltration of the Exodus, and the infiltration of our migrant justice movements. And so, something that I've witnessed is, the doxing of members of our movements and infiltration. So there's people that are simultaneously introducing meth to asylum seekers, which is just, not to stigmatize drug use. Like, that's not at all what I'm intending to do. It's just, it destabilizes the movement, and also it creates the weaponization of folks who are seeking asylum by then accusing them of being drug users and stigmatizing them for their drug use when, these are highly traumatized populations. And then also, like, US-based activists are then accused of introducing drugs to the caravan, and that's also how our work gets delegitimized. And so, I don't know, something I really want to uplift moving forward is that we really have to phase into the next stage of our security culture, our security practices, really building trust and getting to know who we're working with. Because, I mean, I really didn't feel safe many times, but I took risks to make sure that youth were safe. I also will say that youth, the very few services that are offered to youth, are not culturally competent in Tijuana. So the youth do not have right now, like previously, the limited resources that youth had access to were perpetuating abuse onto them. And so even though donations were directed towards certain organizations that claim to support youth, the resources weren't reaching the youth. So a need I'm noticing is working with Mexican activists to transform the law that criminalizes providing services to unaccompanied migrant youth, because it's just an outrage that transporting or housing unaccompanied migrant youth is would cost you a felony in Mexico. That's just a total outrage, because that just criminalizes both the people that are doing the job that governments are supposed to do, and it just puts people in even more of a vulnerable place. And so I've seen it all. I mean, I witnessed abductions, I witnessed murders, and I didn't always feel safe, and I sometimes didn't know who I could trust, and that's not okay. So I think moving forward, and to just witness the chronic anxiety experienced by people out there is devastating. And for folks to think that you know, for folks to think that it's going to get better upon crossing into the U.S. is also devastating, because what happens is that youth, I'm talking about youth because I worked with them the closest, but to see the conditions that they're forced into in Tijuana, and then to consider that then they're placed into contemporary Native American boarding schools. This is what ethnic cleansing looks like in 2019. And what is ethnic cleansing but a stage of genocide? It's ethnocide. And so for youth to have to leave their homelands and be away from their communities because they are protesting. They are protesting being drafted into the drug war. They don't want to be the fucking soldiers of the cartels, who by extension are organized crime that work with governments. Like, let's talk about how governments are part of organized crime. And these youth are protesting that. They're like, we're not going to be your foot soldiers. So then they come, they migrate, and then they're put into boarding schools that disconnect them from their communities and their people. And it's traumatizing. I mean, I have no connection with the youth that I was working with in Tijuana, and I'm personally traumatized from that. And the circumstances that led me to have to leave my work with them were also traumatizing, because I was asking too many questions about the structures of the infrastructure, the gaps of services accessible to unaccompanied migrant youth. I was asking too many questions. I was interrogating men who are well networked in Tijuana, and it wasn't safe for me. And I'm pissed about it, because now these youth are in the U.S. system, and how do we continue to have these relationships with them? And to then also think about how the white led NGOs working in Tijuana have this policy of like, oh, you can't get too attached with the youth. You're just bound to end up heartbroken, or you'll get too traumatized, or you're supposed to have boundaries in working with youth. I find that to be so dehumanizing and culturally incompetent. So I'm still trying to figure out a way to address how some of the organizations that are actually US-based organizations operating in Tijuana are culturally incompetent and not providing trauma-informed care. And they are not members of the Central American community, so they are not familiar with the intergenerational collective trauma we have as a people. And we really need to talk about how important it is to support Central American organizers in providing these services to the youth, because you know, it's like our extended family from our homeland. You know, we have common ancestors. So, I mean, for me, right now, my model of accompaniment, and I just want to continue on this since I have good connection for a sec. My model of accompaniment looks like this, and I really want to advocate for more people adopting this model of accompaniment instead of just kind of doing disaster tourism and just exhausting resources. I think we really need to be strategic in where we allocate our resources, and that we make sure that it's people who are intimately familiar with the historical conditions that facilitated this stage of ethnocide and genocide, and that we support people who are intimately familiar, who are culturally competent in providing these services to asylum seekers, and that we, if we go to Tijuana or if we travel, we work on having long-term commitments instead of just, you know, going, witnessing, and then going back and, you know, not really following up with the work. Because right now, I'm continuing to support those folks that I risk my life to support in Tijuana, because what does it matter if I support them in Tijuana and then abandon them while they're in the fucking concentration camps and then get deported back to conflict zones in our homelands, you know? So for me, abolition looks like full on accompaniment from beginning to end. So just want to uplift that. And again, also we need to talk about divesting from the war economy, but that's a whole nother conversation.
Well, yeah, just one other larger overarching question. We wanted to talk about, you know, institutionalized ethnic cleansing, both in terms of policy and just how the state kind of views things. You know, and this is something that, you know, we could talk about Palestine, we could talk about the United States. You know, one thing that we've talked a lot about is the influence that groups like FAIR or Federation for American Immigration Reform, so-called, and like the other think tanks that are connected to it, Numbers USA, Center for Immigration Studies. I mean, how they come out of the white nationalist movement and they really promote, you know, a form of eugenics and white nationalism that really wants to just massively deport millions and millions of people that definitely could be seen as a form of, you know, it is ethnic cleansing. And, you know, very much they're tied into the Trump administration. They've had people elected from their group into positions of power. Probably the most well-known is Chris Kobach. But yeah, I'm curious to get your thoughts on that.
Until we really have the conversation about capitalism and U.S. intervention and how we're really going to destabilize these countries or really stop the stabilization of these countries that are essentially benefiting the U.S., we're never going to have a solution, right? These are band-aids. I can bring as many as aid, food, doctors to Tijuana. I can support, you know, post detention, during detention, work, which we do. We exhaustively do, believe it or not. It's not going to change the conditions until we truly have these conversations and we truly, really, in my opinion, you know, fight for a revolution, which is not going to be in our homelands, right? It's not going to be in the U.S., right? We really have to do, we have to have an international, transnational lens on how we're going to liberate our people from Palestine to Mexico to Central America to Haiti to African nations and so on, right? Because these are just band-aids, right? And we're not going to go anywhere. These caravans are going to continue happening. The displacement of hundreds of people, not just from Central America, from all over the world is happening.
And to add on to that, so we're talking about institutionalized ethnic cleansing. And so I recently had the opportunity to go to the UN for the Commission on Narcotic Drugs and continuing, you know, the conversation about the prohibition of drugs, right? So this was a space where member states, there's about like 130 countries that are signed on to international drug conventions, and the drug conventions outline, you know, a commitment to creating a drug-free world. And so let's talk about how that's just like super unrealistic, right? And it just continues a legacy of the prohibition of psychoactive medicine, right? And so when the war on drugs is perpetuated worldwide, it creates the justification for the expansion of globalized militarization. And so what happens is that this benefits multinational corporations that are seeking to displace indigenous communities from their territories, and the proliferation of arms that plagues, for example, Latin America, then, you know, infiltrates the networks of cartels that are then hired as the private security firms and the paramilitaries for the multinational corporations that are displacing the indigenous populations that are then forced to migrate. So when multinational corporations are trying to take over indigenous territory, they'll destabilize the territory with cartel violence and with paramilitary violence. And that's how some of the forced migration happens. Or when there's indigenous activism in an area that's trying to resist hydroelectric dams. So when there's indigenous activists that are organizing against multinational projects, who gets hired to repress them? It's the cartels. So there's definitely organized crime happening between governments, cartels, and again, it's just like forcing, exacerbating this exodus. And it's just, you know, the open air prisons that are the responses to mass migrations that are fleeing violence caused by the war on drugs and by environmental injustice is then responded with concentration camps. I mean, did folks see the open air prison that a factory in Mexico was turned into, what we saw in El Paso a few weeks ago? Yeah. I mean, this is just a total expansion of open air prisons, and the separation of families is ethnocide. I mean, we're still recuperating from the trauma of Native children being abducted from from their communities in the 20th century. And this is a total repetition of that. Like, I mean, these youth, I mean, this is just the replication of trauma. So this is institutionalized ethnocide for sure.
Yeah. And also understanding that one of the fastest industries in Central America, a growing industry, is security and surveillance, right? Like, people it's becoming a multi-million like companies, and we're talking about like all these securities and all these different police entities that are buying, you know, guns from the United States and all these surveillance. It's very profitable, and the U.S. needs Central America to be a hot mess and Mexico to be a hot mess to excuse all of its intervention.
I mean, one thing for me that this brings up is that I was listening to a climate scientist talk, and they were saying that, you know, within the next 10 years, there's going to be millions of people being displaced through climate change. And I just wonder if so much of this smart border stuff, all this buildup, you know, military infrastructure, is just getting ready for, you know, what's already happening and now, but on a much greater scale, as people, you know, leaving their homelands or leaving wherever to, you know, go north where it's colder.
I mean, it's true. Absolutely true. It's crazy, because I remember when I started revisiting El Salvador and Central America about 10 years ago, everything that is happening now, a lot of the social movements were warning us about. Right. They're using this as an excuse because they want control of the raw minerals. They want control of so on, so on. They're going to use this as an excuse. Everything. Right. And I mean, 10 years later, everything they said is happening. So I'm not surprised.
You want to give any shout outs or encourage people to donate or check out any certain, either could be media projects, groups, organizations? If there's anything coming up that you really want to plug, or if you have anything that you've worked on that you want to plug?
I don't know. There's a lot going on. I think, honestly, the one thing is we definitely need all hands on deck when it comes to this issue. Just going back to echo what Cielito said, is the fact that we need to be very mindful of the white supremacist perspectives that we're bringing in, and we have to be really cautious on how we interact with asylum seekers. And it really has to be from a place of healing and a place of really truly being, you know, in this struggle with people. It sickens me to see people who think they're helping and come to Tijuana and are really just creating and making the problem worse. You know, people are not, it's not like this, like trauma porn. It's not an amusement park to come see asylum seekers. Don't come take pictures of them without their consent. Humanize that experience. Yes, it's horrible what's happening and the world needs to see those awful images, but also humanize, because within the caravans, there's some dope ass organizers, these strong women and children and men that have fled with everything to lose and have such a strength that is admirable, and not take away that autonomy and their agency. And I think that's something that people need to learn when working with asylum seekers.
So on my end, I think, you know, folks are interested in staying connected. Please follow on Instagram, Caravan Support Network. And then on Twitter, it would be at Caravana Support. So that's Caravan with an A after the N and then support after. Although I would say that there are other efforts too that are growing. I recommend people check out Block the Wall, which is a growing movement to mobilize to obstruct border expansion. But I do want to draw attention that there is still, like, we're still working on the movement building, right? So how to build bridges between migrant, indigenous communities. We still have a lot of racial healing to do within our movement. So I also want to encourage folks listening to work on racial and gender justice, because we really need to be strong for what is to come.
Yeah. And then another way to keep a, I don't say track, but just get informed of the work that that's happening beyond Mexico, like Central America and their struggles, you can follow CISPES, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, online. CISPES, they have various chapters, and this is a 37-year-old transnational solidarity organization that has been supporting the Salvadoran and Central American struggles since the early 80s, and they're very much involved in supporting movements in Central America to make sure that, you know, we don't see more displacement. So that's a good resource for folks.
Also, if you're listening and you want to directly support asylum seekers, just reach out to It's Going Down, and we can make sure that those resources reach asylum seekers. There's just a lot of different efforts, so we can definitely plug you into supporting, whether it's an individual or maybe like you want to support summer programs for unaccompanied migrant youth in Los Angeles. Please don't hesitate to reach out to It's Going Down, and they'll just reach out to us. We'll make sure that those funds get to where they need to be.
You know, just one last question from us. You know, we've asked a couple people this, and I know you all are in the thick of it all the time in a variety of different angles, but you know, we were just so excited last summer when the Abolish ICE thing kind of broke out. But it seemed like within that, there was, like, part of the reason that that exploded was because of the viral nature of the videos and everything like that. And it almost feels sometimes like we need that to happen. Whereas a lot of times, like, that component necessarily isn't there. And I'm just curious, you know, how can we kind of get beyond that? Like, when we have to literally move and mobilize, and like that kind of viral aspect isn't there, it almost feels like people are kind of waiting for it to really kind of go viral first or something like that. Whereas I almost feel like that's a new development within social movements, and it's I don't see it as a good thing.
Yeah, well, I think we have to have a really honest conversation about what are we willing to do, right? How much are we willing to risk, and for the sake of the collective struggle, and if we're willing to put our bodies in the line, right? Like, as someone who has a family that fought a civil war, and I always grew up wondering, like, the craziest thing is you have to make war to get peace. Or what does it, you know, what is that moment in your life when someone realized, okay, I'm going to take arms and I'm going to fight? I'm not saying to go fight, right? What I'm saying is that we really have to be critical about that. And it has to go far beyond what we're doing right now if we truly want to see change. I don't know how that looks like, but I do want to encourage people for you to have a real conversation with yourself about how far you're willing to go. You know, people, and historically, like, if you look at social movements or in the history of the past 40 years from, like, let's just say the civil rights movements to now, there is many people that risk their lives for the collective good. So it's something that we got to talk about, and we don't talk enough about. And it's scary, and I understand it's scary. We have a lot to lose, but we have a lot to gain.
Yeah, from my end, I use every speaking opportunity I can to activate people around the issue. I think everyone is just really oppressed, and people are really, I mean, I'm going to speak to it. A lot of people are so oppressed that they're apathetic, and that's the scariest part to me. So I think part of the work is, right, like I think it's, is it Augusto Boal who says that you have to make the revolution seductive, or the role of the artist is to make revolution seductive? So I'm really trying to think through how one does that. But fuck, like, I shouldn't have to seduce the public to think that caging kids is immoral and that it needs to be immediately stopped. But so just really trying to think through creative approaches to commit people.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.